It is my pleasure to introduce to you Luke Masick, the headmaster of the Lyceum, a classical Catholic school that has received national attention for its outstanding classical curriculum and for the music of the Lyceum's Schola Cantorum. The Lyceum is one of 70 schools in the nation and the only one in Ohio to be recognized by the Cardinal Newman Society's Honor Roll as a school of excellence. Mr. Masick is a board member of the Institute for Catholic Liberal Education, which exists to give Catholic educators a clear understanding of the riches of authentic Catholic education and to help them to implement the Church's vision in their institutions. His topic, Education for Life.
Well, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. First of all, one correction. The founder of the Lyceum is Mr. Mark Langley. He was a classmate of mine at Thomas Aquinas College. And he and I are keeping this ship afloat. As far as the Navajo Indians, I guess Jerry would like me to tell you this story. I represented the Navajo Indians for 15 years. I was their insurance defense counsel. I was in private practice. They hired our law firm, and I did all of their work. So I probably defended about any one time 25, 30 cases. But they're the one jurisdiction in the United States that I'm aware of that's pro-life. They had defined in one of their cases, their Supreme Court, where a woman who had been involved in a car accident, her baby in utero was killed. It was not a viable baby, but that did not matter to the Navajo Indians. What they said was that the child is a human being from the moment of conception. And since the United States Constitution does not apply to them because they are what's called a dependent sovereign nation, and Congress has not made it explicitly applicable to them, Roe v. Wade doesn't apply or anything else. So it was a great place to practice law. I was always waiting for the Navajo grandma to come in to get an injunction in Navajo court to stop an abortion off reservation of a granddaughter. That case didn't happen, but there are other lawyers there who are also ready and waiting for that thing, that type of a case to happen. Perhaps another case I should mention this, the value of a liberal education. I was in one of the biggest cases that they had up till that point on a free speech claim. And the night before my oral argument on a summary judgment that I had filed with the Navajo Supreme Court, I thought this case is going to be an argument about the natural laws, what's going to come up. And they had their own view of the natural law, which was very consistent with anyone's view of the natural law because the natural law is universal. So the night before my hearing, I pulled out my St. Thomas Aquinas to read question, I think, 92 and 93 in the Summa on the natural law. Billed my clients for it because I was preparing for the hearing. I didn't tell them what I was studying. And sure enough, that's what we discussed. And the attorney on the opposite side of the case had no idea what had hit him. As I'm arguing from principles of the natural law and the Navajo judges, his head is going up and down. Yes, I agree. Yes, I agree. So in any event, I am the headmaster of the Lyceum. I was at Wyoming Catholic College as a vice president of administration for 2 years. Prior to that, I went to Thomas Aquinas College, and that's my undergraduate degree. I have an education that's much like the education of the founding fathers in the United States. And so my education and my legal background have often made me think about what's going on in America. Why have we been producing a generation, generations of people who do not respect life from the moment of conception? And it's something that I've thought about often. My teaching at the high school level and junior high level, teaching Greek and Latin, and yes, Euclid, I think it needs to be put back in every curriculum, has made me consider what's gone wrong with education. And so I want to have this two parts to this talk. One is what's wrong and how do we correct it? So the fact that this convention is called Bringing America Back to Life is an implicit recognition that America has embraced the culture of death, and thereby she herself is dead or on the verge of death. She lies before us as one who could easily slip away and be gone forever. since she has no DNR notice posted at her bedside, that's do not resuscitate, I shall therefore be a part of the team of physicians who will attempt to treat her. I will leave it to others here at this convention, however, to attempt to take whatever emergency action is necessary to keep her from slipping away. My part, however, will be to consider what brought her to such a state and what must be done to restore her to good health if she survives the immediate crisis. A quick acknowledgement of the patient's present condition is in order. The culture of death is alive and well within her borders, despite the fact that she can provide her citizens with more than ample means to serve the needs of the body. The number of innocent babies killed in the last 45 years is utterly mind-staggering. How many more children do not even come into existence because America has lost sight of the fact that marriage is for the sake of procreation and the education of children? Worse yet, she now thinks marriage can utterly exclude the distinction of the sexes necessary for procreation. America's disease lies quite deep. It is a sickness of the soul. Already, however, many in our society would clamor that such talk of the soul is at best a poetic metaphor, or worse, sheer nonsense, a notion that can only appeal to Christians or a metaphor with no actual basis in reality. It might be a wonderful thing for poets and Christians to speak about the soul, but America's on the verge of death, and we need a real analysis. We need to employ the advances of modern science and technological advancements to save her. Such a response, however, simply exhibits ever more clearly the nature of the disease. Indeed, we have learned here at this convention over the last 7 years of all the horrific aspects of the culture of death. How did we get here? In his great encyclical Veritatis Splendor, Pope St. John Paul II wrote, "The development of science and technology, this splendid testimony of the human capacity for understanding and for perseverance, does not free humanity from the obligation to ask the ultimate religious questions. Rather, it spurs us on to face the most painful and decisive of struggles, those of the heart and the moral conscience. No one can escape from the fundamental questions, what must I do? How do I distinguish good from evil?" I would like, first of all, to notice that this great teacher about the human person indicates that we have an obligation, a duty. He does not first speak about rights. If there is a time we can come back to this point, for now let me say that the commandment, thou shalt not kill, is the fifth. There are four others that precede it, and one immediately prior to it commands us to honor father and mother. Certainly that means our parents, but in a very real sense, it must also include the fathers of our nation and of Western civilization. We have a duty to honor them. Honor, of course, does not merely mean making statues of them and taking days off of work and school. We must heed their words, their thoughts. How could we do this unless we read their books? And perhaps we must be educated in the same way they were. We must study the same books they did. Let me, though, now return to the words of the Universal Father, Pope St. John Paul II. He continues in Veritatis Splendor. "Once the idea of a universal truth about the good, knowable by human reason, is lost, inevitably the notion of conscience also changes. Conscience is no longer considered in its primordial reality as an act of a person's intelligence, the function of which is to apply the universal knowledge of the good in a specific situation and thus to express a judgment about the right conduct to be chosen here and now." He continues, "Instead, there's a tendency to grant to the individual conscience the prerogative of independently determining the criteria of good and evil and then acting accordingly. Such an outlook is quite congenial to an individualistic ethic wherein each individual is faced with his own truth, different from the truth of others. Taken to its extreme consequences, this individualism leads to a denial of the very idea of human nature. If we must, and we have a duty, according to John Paul, and I think he's right about that, right, to seek the good, right, do good and avoid evil, we have to ask the question, what is a good education? Now, if the good cannot be determined by the prerogative of the individual conscience, i.e. we don't just get to decide for ourselves what a good education is, then we are faced with this question of what's the best education for man as man? The universal truth about human nature obliges human beings who have the leisure to be educated to pursue an education in accordance with the nature which they possess. So your nature determines what education ought to be. Let me say, first of all, that education is seen in relation to work, right? One gets an education for the sake of a job. How many of you have heard that, why you ought to go to school? Let me make three comments about this attitude, all right? Such an idea makes sense if the universal truth about the good knowable by human reason is lost. After all, if you can't know the truth about reality, the most likely reason to be educated is to make one's work as pleasant and as lucrative as possible, and that would mean pursuing an education according to one's personal likes and dislikes and the possibilities for making money according to the work one will someday be obliged to undertake. Point number two. Work, however, as Genesis tells us, is a punishment for sin. And while we certainly must do penance in our lifetime, I don't hear young people or adults suggesting that they are pursuing a particular career in order to do penance. Number three, the only place that work seems to be permanent is in hell, where the damned continue to spend their lives in the continual state of unrest, in the continual work of rebellion against God. As the saying goes, there is no rest for the wicked. How did we come to see work, a punishment for sin and the eternity of the damned, as the end of education, as its purpose? If the truth is not attainable, then there must be some other purpose for education. Let's do a little digging in history and see how the idea of truth has been changed and how that affects the modern educational system and how we view the purpose, therefore, of education. René Descartes, a mathematician, scientist, and so-called philosopher who lived in the 17th century, is known as the father of modern skepticism. A skeptic is one who thinks that knowledge is impossible. Descartes rejected all of his own education in the classical world, which he received at a school called the Lyceum, one of the finest in all of Europe. Since Descartes thought that the truth was unattainable, he wanted to create a universal system for solving problems. Let me repeat that. Since Descartes thought that the truth was unattainable, he wanted to create a universal system for solving problems. He gave Western civilization the universal system of solving problems, modern algebra. It's indeed a very powerful tool for solving problems. I must also mention another individual who is a contemporary of Descartes, who gave modern science much of its impetus, Francis Bacon. Bacon claimed knowledge and human power are synonymous. Let me repeat that. Knowledge and power are synonymous. He also stated, quote, to generate and superinduce a new nature or new natures upon a given body is the labor and aim of human power. Thus, according to Bacon, the aim of human knowledge is to generate new natures upon a given body. I think that we can safely say that under Bacon's understanding of knowledge, Caitlyn Jenner is among the wisest of modern men. How does one demonstrate one's knowledge? Change a thing into something else or somehow harness it to make it useful to man. If you can change the matter of one thing into another or harness it to be used to serve man's needs, then you demonstrate that your knowledge of the thing. You demonstrate the knowledge of the thing. So in order to do this, one has to understand the matter of the thing, and indeed understanding the matter of something is considered the ultimate end of science because we have the knowledge to manipulate the matter, we clearly have power over the thing, and thereby demonstrate our knowledge. Here is the way one of the most popular high school biology books in the country, Biology by Miller and Levine, expresses the importance of understanding the matter. Quote, think about it. This is right in the beginning, I think chapter 1.3. Think about it. What are you made? What are you made of? Just as buildings are made from brick, steel, glass, and wood, living things are made from chemical compounds. But it doesn't stop there. When you breathe, eat, or drink, your body uses the substances in air, food, and water to carry out the chemical reactions that keep you alive. If the first task of an architect is to understand building materials, then what would be the first job of a biologist? Clearly, it is to understand the chemistry of life. And this is his argument to begin to understand organic matter. Let's consider the author's statement. He uses an analogy which compares the biologist to an architect. An architect is the one who is concerned with the highest knowledge in building. It is the architect who designs the building based upon its purpose. Architectonic knowledge in any field is usually considered the highest in the field. Thus, when we say one's knowledge is architectonic, it suggests that one's knowledge is comprehensive and whole. After all, the architect is the one who sees the whole, and in seeing the whole, can design it. I think our author is saying that a biologist has architectonic knowledge about living beings when he understands the matter out of which living beings are made. Let me repeat then what he said. If the task of an architect is to understand building materials, then what would be the first job of a biologist? Clearly, it is to understand the chemistry of life. While I agree that the architect must understand the matter of which a building is made, is that his first job? Architectural structures ought not to be made of jello, but brick and mortar and wood. But if you walked into an architect's office and told him that you wanted to make a building out of brick, mortar, and wood, he would say, all well and good, but he's going to ask you a few important questions. He'll want to know what the shape or form of the building will be and what its purpose is. Not until those are determined will the building materials be considered. A factory, for example, should have a substantially different shape than a school, although it is striking how many schools look like factories. A bomb shelter whose purpose is to protect from explosion may require different matter than a church, but I've seen some churches that don't look much better than decorated bomb shelters. It's quite clear that if you or I employed an architect, we would not expect him to first to begin to show us the building materials that he would use, the brick, the mortar, the wood, but rather to understand what kind of a building we wanted him to make. Do we want him to build a house, a church, school, offices, or a factory? The first job of the architect is not indeed to understand the building materials, but rather to understand the form or the purpose of the building. By his suggestive faulty premise, the author of our high school biology textbook has suggested that architectonic knowledge of living things come from understanding the matter out of which they are made. According to the author of our high school biology book, if one understands the matter of living things, not their form or purpose, which we might call the formal or final causes, one's knowledge will be complete and architectonic. This makes some sense if knowledge is power, because if you can manipulate the matter and use it to make something else, say, for example, using living matter of a baby in the womb for an adult, then according to the Baconian principle that knowledge is power, you demonstrate that you have knowledge over the thing. But a real architect will give a certain shape to a football stadium because it is intended to provide for a large number of people to watch the same event. On the other hand, he will give a different shape to a house, which is for the purpose of providing shelter and living space for a family. It's no accident, however, that the author of our high school biology book has given the characteristic of architectonic knowledge to the material cause. The roots of the scientific view of the world were established by Francis Bacon and René Descartes, who believed that science was concerned with solving problems and being able to manipulate matter by changing one thing into another, since knowledge and power, after all, are the same thing. In the modern scientific view, which pervades the thinking in our grade schools and high schools, the only real knowledge, the real science, the only thing that men can count on as being true because knowledge is power, are the physical sciences, and these exclude by definition the very idea of considering what the architect really considers, which is the form or the purpose of a thing. How does this view of knowledge affect the pro-life cause? We must look at the habits of mind that such a view forms in our children from kindergarten through college and beyond. If architectonic knowledge excludes the formal and final causes, then living things, as the author of our biology textbooks asserts, are simply a conglomerate of building blocks of organic matter. This view is quite commonplace and pervasive in the very nature of a curriculum which is based wholly on the idea that knowledge is power over matter. Thus, most elementary and high school science books will say something like this, quote, cells are the building blocks of all living things, end quote. And, quote, all life activities take place in cells, end quote. Once you've granted the principle that all life activities take place in cells, then you have denied in principle that the principle of life for all living things is its formal cause. Or, to state that more formally, by saying that all life activities take place in cells, in principle you have denied that the principle of life of all living things is the soul, which is simply another name for the principle of life. This notion that human beings are simply a conglomerate of cells is commonplace. Just this past week, Pope Francis himself said the modern culture has reduced human nature, quote, to mere matter that may be molded according to any design, end quote. Thus, it was at my niece's convocation, a year and a half ago, when she received her PhD from the University of Chicago, she and her fellow graduate students were greeted by Dr. David Archer, PhD in oceanography at the University of Chicago, as, quote, my fellow carbon atoms, end quote. He told them quite calmly and serenely that humans were not special among Earth's creatures because we are built of the same materials as the, quote, liverworts and slime molds, the basic scum of the Earth, end quote. Of course, when the slime mold gets in the way of your style of living, you get rid of it. If there is no difference between human beings and slime molds, disposing of a baby according to the best and the brightest is no different than disposing of slime molds. Despite this despicable opinion that human beings are a conglomeration of cells and are not special among Earth's creatures, the only place that students and parents alike think that reality can be known with certainty is in math and science classes, for it's there that power has been made manifest. Moreover, it will be manifest in their own lives when they land the high-paying job as doctor, engineer, or research physicist. The men of science and mathematics have demonstrated their knowledge by the power wielded over nature. It's all around us. Who could deny it? The advances of modern science are extraordinary, and therefore we conclude that where there is power, there is knowledge. In our educational system, we also conclude that unless there is power, there is no certain knowledge. Of course, then, what is the trend in modern education? STEM, you've all heard it, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So if you really want to secure that good-paying job, if you really want to understand reality, you pursue a path in the sciences and technology. Now, if knowledge and power are synonymous, then of course those who can create the most powerful things must have the most knowledge. The modern physicist might be the most powerful of all, for he has taught mankind how to release the power of the atom. Indeed, modern man seems to attribute the highest knowledge to the physicist, for he acquires the knowledge of the building blocks, not only of living things, but of everything. Is it no wonder that the modern world hears Richard Dawkins with a kind of authority which was once only the realm of the medieval theologian? Max Born, a physicist who was very instrumental in developing the theory of quantum mechanics, and whose students, particular student Enrico Fermi, was responsible for creating the first nuclear reactor and gave us the atom bomb. Born received the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1954. And in his Nobel Prize lecture, he said this, quote, I believe that ideas such as absolute certitude, absolute exactness, final truth, etc., are figments of the imagination which should not be admissible in any field of science. On the other hand, an assertion of probability is either right or wrong from the standpoint of the theory on which it is based. This loosening of thinking seems to me to be the greatest blessing which modern science has given to us. For the belief in a single truth and in being the possessor thereof is the root cause of all evil in the world. Now, 10 years later, he writes a reflection in a journal of science. And this one I want you to listen to very closely. Quote again, "I am haunted by the idea that the break in human civilization caused by the discovery of the scientific method may be irreparable. Though I love science, I have the feeling that it is so much against history and tradition that it cannot be absorbed by our civilization. The political and military horrors and complete breakdown of ethics which I have witnessed during my life may not be a symptom of an ephemeral social weakness, but a necessary consequence of the rise of science, which is in itself one of the highest intellectual achievements of man. If this is so, this will be the end of man as a free, responsible being. Should the race not be extinguished by a nuclear war, it will degenerate into a flock of stupid, dumb creatures under the tyranny of dictators who will rule them with the help of machines and electronic computers. This is no prophecy, just a nightmare," end quote. I think 1965. "This is no prophecy, just a nightmare. Born saw no way out of the dilemma. We must, however, regain a view of science that is older than the scientific method." In his Regensburg lecture, Pope Benedict XVI questioned the very modern concept of reason. Quote, "This modern concept of reason is based, to put it briefly, on a synthesis between Cartesianism and empiricism, a synthesis confirmed by the success of technology. On the one hand, it presupposes the mathematical structure of matter, its intrinsic rationality, which makes it possible to understand how matter works and use it efficiently. On the other hand, there is nature's capacity to be exploited for our purposes, and here only the possibility of verification or falsification through experimentation can yield decisive certainty. The weight between the two poles can, depending on the circumstances, shift from one side to the other." Pope Benedict continues, "This gives rise to two principles which are crucial for the issue we have raised. First, only the kind of certainty resulting from the interplay of mathematical and empirical elements can be considered scientific. Anything that would claim to be science must be measured against this criterion. A second point, which is important for our reflections, is that by its very nature, this method excludes the question of God, making it appear an unscientific or pre-scientific question. Consequently, we are faced with a reduction of the radius of science and reason, one which needs to be questioned." Pope Benedict and Max Born seem to be in agreement. The reduction of the radius of reason to the scientific method must itself be questioned. Aristotle, after his school, our little Lyceum is named, the ancient Greek scientist and philosopher of Athens, the man with whom scientific thinking began, did not think understanding the matter alone gave a complete knowledge of a thing. Through an analogy, which is beyond the scope of this talk to analyze thoroughly with artificial things, he considered that we have a complete knowledge when we consider the material, efficient, formal, and final causes, much the way an architect would have to consider not only what materials he might use and how they might be put together, but more importantly, what is the purpose of the building he is making? What shape might it have to be most conducive to such a purpose? Or consider how a chair comes into being. There is the matter, the wood, the shape, the four legs and a back, the purpose so that you can sit upright and listen to long lectures. And of course, it took a chair maker with the art of making chairs to form the wood. To completely grasp living things, therefore, we would have to understand their formal causes or principles of life, not merely their matter. Thus, to understand plant, animal, and man, we would have to take up a consideration of the vegetative, animal, and rational souls. The consideration of the rational soul, that is, the soul that reasons, such, of course, supposes that reason is not a material activity of brain synapses, would lead us to realize that there is a soul that does not die with the body, but which can exist independent of the body. All of these considerations are a part of natural science, real science, but a view of science not limited artificially by a definition that equates knowledge with power. Through real science, we might even get to a knowledge of God, the uncaused cause of all things. Indeed, in his letter to the Romans, St. Paul grasps the obstacles to real scientific thinking. He writes, "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made." As if you can see reality, if you can see creation, you can see these things. So St. Paul continues, "They are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanging the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to a dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural, and the men likewise gave up natural relations, and they were consumed with passion for one another." Sounds like he's describing our times. How do we recover the ability to reason? Well, to think about all of the causes. Let's pay attention to the fourth commandment. Honor our fathers and mothers. Honor our fathers of Western civilization. We must recover the thoughts of the ancient Greeks and Romans and the fathers and holy doctors of the church, especially through the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, who himself so brilliantly preserved the thoughts of that pagan scientist of ancient Greece, Aristotle. What better way to preserve the thoughts of the ancient Greeks and Romans than requiring our children to learn their languages? One should begin by recovering the study of classical Greek and of Latin, for it was through the Romans that we have contact with the Greek world. How important is this, to study Greek and Latin? Let me recount the words of Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, in his book Milestones Memoirs. There he gives an account of his education when he was a boy in the little town of Traunstein. There were two schools in that town, quote, "the gymnasium for classical languages," all right, "where the students studied Latin and Greek, and the scientific school." Benedict XVI relates that when the Nazis came into power, quote, "the two schools were combined into one, in which the study of Greek completely disappeared, Latin was greatly diminished, with instruction beginning only in the third year, and in which modern languages, especially English and the natural sciences, instead received much greater weight. 3 years later, religious instruction was banned from the schools, with its place taken by physical education and sports," end quote. What was imposed by the Nazis, we in the United States have willingly embraced at the heart of our educational experience in high school, science and sports. Why were the Nazis so adamant about getting rid of Greek and Latin? Because those languages put students in direct contact with thinkers who knew the truth about man. It was the writing of these authors that formed the founding fathers of our country. When you go back and you look at the founding fathers, half of them were educated. Who did they study? They studied most of them were fluent in Latin and Greek to some measure. They studied Aristotle. They studied the works of the ancient Romans, the ancient Greeks. Pope Benedict, again, said this of his own education. "In retrospect, it seems to me that an education in Greek and Latin antiquity created a mental attitude that resisted seduction by totalitarian ideology. And Pope St. John the 23rd himself also stated, quote, "The wisdom of the ancient world, enshrined in Greek and Roman literature, served surely to herald the dawn of the gospel. Thus, the inauguration of Christianity did not mean the obliteration of man's past achievements. Nothing was lost that was in any way true, just, noble, and beautiful. The Church has ever held the literary evidence of this wisdom in the highest esteem. She values especially the Greek and Latin languages in which wisdom itself is cloaked, as it were, in a vesture of gold." Recovering the study of Greek and Latin also demands that we recover the liberal arts, which are those arts of learning, grammar, rhetoric, and logic, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, which were the arts of a free man. They are not arts ordered to something external and therefore lower than man, but are ordered to the perfection of his mind. And when a man's mind works well, all of creation speaks to him of the glory of God. The liberal arts, these tools of learning, as they have been called, allow man to think well and to be the master of his words in his intellect so as not to be a slave to them in his passions, as Dorothy Sayers says in her article, The Lost Tools of Learning. When we begin to care about the right use of words and the mastery of the liberal arts, we are far more likely to see that our nature obligates us to seek the truth. And as the God-man said, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Thank you.
Excellent. Great. Well, please be seated. And you know, the standing ovation was not just from your students. So that was great. If it was just the students, I would have said, well, they have a vested interest. But yes, questions. The importance of the classical languages, Latin. I took Latin in high school. And for all of you Lyceum students here, get out a pen and a piece of paper. And I want you to write down a translation. And whoever gets it right gets special extra credit from the headmaster here. And it is the only thing I remember from high school Latin, which is quite a long time ago. Semper ubi sub ubi. The young lady in red. Very good. Always wear underwear. It's not the proper way to say it, of course, but it's just putting the words together. But that's how valuable Latin was to me in high school, unfortunately. Okay, that was very good. I thought it was going to take a while. Okay, so let me give this to Luke. The first question, let me just quickly look at them here. Oh, this is a good one. How is Common Core a threat as many Catholic schools are implementing its standards?
Well, I love the Common Core of Western civilization. But actually, I love the Common Core for this reason too. My phone has been ringing more off, you know, been ringing a lot more than it used to because people are concerned about it. Actually, the Common Core isn't at the heart of the problem. It does add to the problem, but the fact of the matter is the Common Core is just taking these principles that already exist in education. They're already there, and it's making them explicit in a way that they've never been made explicit before. But what's been going on in the last 100 years is fairly close to what the Common Core itself is already just taking to a new extreme. That's all it's doing. So is it a threat? Sure, because if you're concerned merely with some kind of development of what's at the heart of the Common Core is producing graduates who will fit into jobs then you've already gone back to this idea of a slavish education, not a liberal education for free men. And that's, of course, dangerous to a country which prides itself on being free.
Okay, thank you. This question is signed by all the Lyceum students. We love it when you talk about Euclid. I guess it's not a question, it's a statement. Okay, you got some more? Okay, probably better than the last one here. Okay, how does Latin and Greek give us the truth about life?
I think it orders your minds. They are inflected languages, and life is ordered. When we are ordered, when our minds are ordered, we live well. So in that sense, just by the fact that it's ordering students' minds, and it's also ordering their thoughts. Both languages are very logical in their structure, and having then an ordered mind will enable one to think well. But I have to say something about Euclid. No student should graduate from high school in the United States without studying Euclidean geometry. And if you're sitting in there, and if you're 60 or 70 years old sitting here or older, go back and do the first six books of Euclid's geometry. Abraham Lincoln, my students have heard this story millions of times. One of them's shaking her head now. Oh no, Mr. Masick, there he goes again. So Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer, and practiced law, and he one day just realized, I don't know what it means to demonstrate something, and he started investigating this, and someone finally put him onto Euclid's Elements. And Euclid's Elements has the first six books are 187 propositions. Lincoln mastered those 187 propositions and went, oh, this is what demonstrate means. Because, of course, in the courtroom, he had to demonstrate, you know, his case. He had to lay out his case, and he realized he just didn't know what that was to demonstrate. When you read the Gettysburg Address, you'll see it greatly influenced by his study of Euclidean geometry, and I would highly encourage it.
Great. Didn't know that about Lincoln. I only got through three of those books on geometry, so I'll have to bone up on the other three. Let's see here. How do you suggest we combine classical liberal arts with modern science so our institutions can be governed by men of virtue?
Well, it means that schools will actually have to adopt the classical model. They'll have to begin to focus on those things. And then there has to be a bridge, because the bridge, the idea is faith and science are separated. And really what the faith and science being separated means, knowledge in its full sense, which is what the Greeks had, all right, and modern knowledge are separated. But one has to recover, right, a notion of the four causes. What that includes, modern science has the efficient and material cause down. What it lacks is the formal and the final cause. Well, in order to bridge that gap, you've got to go back really to Aristotle, because he's the first scientist of the West, and he's the one that established and looked at these four causes in his work, The Physics. So that means people are going to have to actually start reading Aristotle. Here's what happens in the modern scientific world is, well, here's the statement. The modern scientist says, we have overthrown Aristotle's physics with modern science, and therefore we're going to just skip the physics, and then, well, maybe we'll study his metaphysics, the things where he starts considering questions, meanings about words. And of course, in his physics even, Aristotle gets to an understanding that there must be a first cause. There has to be an uncaused cause. Well, that was real science, and I think we have to recover that. At the Lyceum, we've actually designed a little class. I've designed a class which is a science class. We teach to our sophomores, and we read some of Aristotle's physics, and we analyze. We do a lot of discussion because these aren't easy ideas. But we have to begin to get out of the checklist mentality, right? Sort of when a lot of students go to school and go, well, done that, check, check, check. And you actually have to begin to think deeply And that means getting at the root of what are your own presuppositions and force students to do that. And that's why at the Lyceum we use the Socratic method of learning. We don't want them to memorize what we say. We want them to begin to go, what are these great authors saying? And then, is it true? So read the great authors and go back to Aristotle.
Great, great. Excellent. You know what I remember about Euclid? It's also called Route 20. You West Siders probably don't realize that, but okay. Here's a great question. I'm going to rephrase it a little bit, but basically the substance of it is for adults who were not classically educated, who are not going to sit down and read six tomes of geometry and so on, that sort of thing, where's a good place to get started, and how could they sort of educate themselves without going back to classes and that sort of thing?
There's a wonderful little book that might give you the encouragement you need, because I don't think there's any substitute for actually reading the classics. So you could take one of the former justices of the Supreme Court of last century. When he was 92 years old, somebody walked into his office and he was reading Plato. And they said, well, why are you doing that? He said, well, because I want to be educated. So I don't think there's any substitute. However, if you want to at least get an introduction into this world, I highly recommend a book called the Classical Liberal Arts Tradition. It's put out by a company, the Academic Press, I believe it is. I've handed that book out to every one of my parents this year at my school for them to begin to understand what classical education is. So I think I've got the right title down, the Classical Liberal Arts Tradition by the Classical, you remember, Mr. Langley? Classical Academic Press or something. You try, just look it up on the internet or come see me later and I'll find it for you. But it'll be a book that will help you to get into this. But finally, the hard work of becoming classically educated is just, it's a delightful work. Don't think it's too hard. It's not work. I should get, forgive me, mea culpa for using that term. But in order to be free, it takes much effort and thinking and using one's time wisely.
Okay. Thank you. Since we have a couple minutes left, any questions that from the audience that you didn't write down? Yes, sir. Just yell it out loud, please. Stand up.
The peripatetic method sounds wonderful. I think there is some historical evidence that worked. That was certainly the method of some of the ancient Greeks. So any way you can get it, I would say yes. Excellent. It seems to me that in having this background enables one to engage in conversation with others who don't have it, to ask the right questions. So, for example, when you have Socrates in ancient Athens, right, he's the gadfly there for the evils of in that city, and he's the gadfly there who knows how to ask the right questions. His ability to ask the right questions, right, at the right time and at the right moment, all right, were a result of his own education and reading and thinking. And actually, one of the questions that Socrates himself ponders, and he mentions this, he was very excited about the science of his own day and age. He thought, they are going to give me real answers. And then as he began to investigate the atomist of his own day, he was sorely disappointed and said, they finally don't see reality. So, right, having this education, in one sense, it makes other people begin to think, because what it allows us to do, right, when we read these great authors who are always challenging our ideas, it then allows us to develop that habit to challenge others, right, and ask them questions, the questions that will get to their conscience, because the light of the conscience is always there in human beings. It's always there. All right. And that's really that light of Christ within man. And we've got to let that shine forth. But remember this darkness that comes, right, from this whole view that when you see Max Born saying what he said about the scientific method, and that's it. That's where science is. That's all of reality. Well, when you see that, all right, as the ground to say, hey, well, wait a minute. Let's ask about that. Why are you making those claims? So I think that's the way, if there is any. There's no real method, in fact, I think, right, except for the fact that we have to educate ourselves continually so that when we need to speak and ask the right questions, guided to the truth, we're able to do that. Now, as it got Socrates in trouble, it will probably get us in trouble in many ways, but, you know, that's it.
We want you to stay around here. Well, let's get one more question. There's a young man in the back.
I think so.
I think you just nailed down an A for the semester. Yeah, one more question. Let's see what this. Huh? Oh, the title of the book. I'm sorry. Here, Luke, you can tell them what the title of the book is.
Okay, here we go. Somebody looked it up. The Liberal Arts Tradition, A Philosophy of Christian Classical Education by Kevin Clark. These were two high school students, high school teachers in Florida who started looking at this and just were amazed by what they were finding and really put together a nice little book. I don't agree with everything in this, but if you want a great overview, this is the book I think to read that it will explain this tradition to you very well.
A couple of things. So first of all, let's give it up for Luke Masick, the headmaster. Great job.
You've been listening to Luke Masick, the headmaster of the Lyceum, and a 2016 Bringing America Back to Life convention speaker.